Welcome back to Ben Lee in Quarantine, the podcast where Ben Lee is in quarantine and I, Max Quinn, g'day, have some questions. Today, Birth 2012 and brand marketing. Ben deliberates whether or not it's okay to judge a spiritual movement by the way it markets itself. And I explain how I accidentally created a viral branding movement of my own in 2019. You also get notes on touring with Dashboard Confessional, eating at Sizzler, and the right-wing propaganda film Plandemic. But first, what's happening in the outside world, and what's with all the free samples? That's what's coming up right now on Ben Lee in Quarantine. Hello, Ben.
Hello, sir.
Firstly, I have some notes on the outside world for you.
Oh, what's happening?
Well, I went to do my Christmas shopping today.
Okay.
And as I was doing it, it's been really funny doing this podcast. It's like I have this friend in like suspended animation in the cornstarch of the universe. And so now as I'm encountering like the minutiae of this pandemic in its waning stages in Australia, I often find myself thinking things like, I'll encounter something really small and be like, wait until Ben sees this.
That's awesome. It's like you're one of those like serial killer groupies that like writes letters to Jeffrey Dahmer in prison or something.
So today the thing was free samples are back. And I thought that might blow your mind because if you were looking for an entry point into just how little the coronavirus is an issue here in Australia.
Yeah.
Like, look no further than the throng of dads in shorts grabbing at the fistfuls of free pork and cheese on toothpicks outside the butcher in the heart of metropolitan Sydney.
Yeah, I mean, any shared self-service buffet-style food is... I mean, I sort of thought that might be a thing of the past. Post-COVID. I'm surprised people are... Have you been to like anywhere with like a self-service buffet?
No, I've not been to one of those. And I think they, they got rid of all the Sizzlers.
Yeah.
RIP.
I have a certain nostalgia for Sizzler, for the ice cream sundae.
You know,
ice cream sundae bar, yeah.
one of my favorite songs has a line about Sizzler in it. Do you know the band Clem Snide?
That Stairway to Heaven? Yeah. Clem Snide, of course. Yep.
Yeah, like that's one of my favorite bands. And the song Joan Jett of Arc. He's talking about going on a date with a girl to a Sizzler.
Brilliant.
And it's all you could eat at the Sizzler that night. And it's just like one of those things that I get a little rush of nostalgia for as well. Beautiful songwriter too, that guy.
Yeah, that was always a stop after late night shopping on Thursday nights. Bit of a visit to Sizzler when I was growing up.
So the free samples was one thing that made me think of you. And then the other thing that made me think of you today, because it made me think of Barbara Marx Hubbard, who I've been doing a bit of research into, was this car that was parked a few streets away from me in Glebe that had, it was a Mustang, first of all, and it had the license plate M-U-S-T-A-G, Mustang.
Mustang. Economical use of lettering.
we'll be generous and say economical.
Yeah.
The reason that it made me think, though, of Barbara Marx Hubbard is because I was researching this event that she did called Birth 2012, all caps, and the Venn diagram point of intersection between anthropology and like sheer nomenclature. I don't know how to pronounce that word, nomenclature.
That was a very impressive attempt, if that was your first attempt.
Thank you.
It was good. Yeah.
Like when it comes to someone's global movement called Birth 2012, that's something that I find incredibly funny because it's the point at which I noticed that my inner skeptic, much as the way it was with Mustag, was like, I'm out. This feels silly or culty or both. And I guess...
Is it the arrogance of it?
Well, yeah, I think it might be. I think it's the presumption that you will be willing to buy into this thing that I've called Birth 2012, which is an incredibly obtuse title, or that I will look at your Mustang and need to read the license plate and go, oh, that's what it is. And so I'm wondering to what extent that you can judge a book by its cover in these spiritual communities, and to what extent that you should?
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, there's this guy called Mickey Willis who directed a movie called Plandemic.
Yeah.
That has been a very big part of, you'd call it like QAnon adjacent indoctrination material.
Yep.
It hit a pain point for people in the world who were sort of like, what's going on? And it explained it in a with a conspiratorial explanation and background. And it was a piece of onboarding material. Now, what's interesting is that guy who made it, Mickey Willis, I've actually known him very casually over the years. He lived in Ohio. But my wife, Ione, who is a very good judge of character, we went to something many years ago called the Ayahuasca Monologues. And it was people talking about their experiences with ayahuasca.
Mm.
And Mickey Willis stood up and made a speech that was, it was sort of like, he was actually more a host of the evening, I think, and he ended up introducing someone he said was a personal hero of his. And it was this guy who had walked across America, sort of like spontaneously, like Forrest Gump or something.
Okay.
And as a peace protest. But he had a little tidbit of trivia that was thrown in at the beginning was that he'd left his wife and two children at home and just went walking across America. And Mickey Willis was like, this guy is my personal hero, the type of courage he has, I wish I had it. And Ione just turned to me and she was like, what a dick, or something like that. Because it was, you know, often in, there's often an inbuilt misogyny or patriarchy in these types of heroic vision quests,
mm-hmm.
where the men are free to go and sit underneath the Bodhi tree for 12, 14 hours a day, and the women are stuck at home with the responsibility of keeping the house and the children running and fed and, you know, all that. So it was interesting how this was long before we knew what direction Mickey Willis's political or spiritual beliefs were going to take him in sort of a path of sort of direct opposition to mine, in a sense.
Sure.
But Ione was like, I don't like what this guy represents.
Yeah.
That made her very uncomfortable as a woman.
Yep, I bet.
And it's funny because there are cases like that where things play out with certain people where years later you go, huh, I sort of saw the seed of that
mm-hmm.
early. So in a sense, perhaps it's a very weird moral to that story. Perhaps judging a book by its cover, it's not really by its cover, because its cover implies that you're making a physical, superficial judgment.
I guess that's
true. Whereas that piece of information that she received firsthand watching someone talk was actually quite a revealing piece of information.
Mm.
You perhaps it's about how potent the first impression is.
That's true.
And in that case, he gave an incredibly potent and very pointed piece of information that expressed something about his value system that proved to be true over time. So, yeah, you can do it. You can do it.
I feel like it takes a very particular set of circumstances for someone to actually be able to ditch what they're doing and walk across the country. And having a family, I just don't think is part and parcel of being able to do that.
Yes, I think, I think there's a long history of men. I don't know if it's just men. I'm thinking of that Bjork song, Hyper Ballad, which is one of my favorite songs of hers. And it's really about the tension between freedom and domesticity. And she talks about sneaking out early in the morning before her partner wakes up and throwing dishes off the cliff and imagining it being her body. Essentially, she's talking about meditating on just complete destruction and how then she can go back and cozy into bed and feel safe with him. What an incredible premise for a pop song, by the way.
Absolutely.
But so I think it's common to men and women. It's just that men, you know, like my wife's dad is Donovan, the folk singer, you know, from the 60s. And she didn't grow up with him. And she has a lot of friends whose parents were 60s and 70s rock icons who were, you could call them varying degrees of neglectful. But it was something that men had the license to do. There's a great book, if for people who are interested in this sort of thing, there's a great book called Off the Road by Carolyn Cassidy, who is Neil Cassidy's wife, you know, who
Neil Cassidy,
so On the Road was based on Dean Moriarty, was the lead character who is Kerouac's best friend in the story. But that was based on Neil Cassidy, and he was very eccentric figure. And he's also, if you read the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, he's the guy driving the further bus across the country. But anyway, it was written by his wife, who was an extremely intelligent, creative writer herself. And the book's called Off the Road, and it's about what happened to the women of that generation. The men were out questing for enlightenment and these transcendent experiences, just wanted to shake off the shackles of society. And the women didn't have the same liberties. And it's a conversation that I think culturally is an important one to have, because there is a counterculture. The story of counterculture has been extremely dominated by white men. Basically, and
there's
some great work. I'm not someone who's going to say, like, man, I mean, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, you know, these figures are
Fugazi.
And Bukowski. I mean, these white male figures are, they're also geniuses too, but there were also geniuses who were not afforded the same kind of attention. And I think we are, we need to retroactively re-examine the narratives that have built us to where we are culturally, and realize that there were counter narratives occurring the whole time that did not have the same spotlight on them.
Counterculture, counter narratives.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. The one walk across a country story that I've heard from a white man that I still find to be profound and interesting is from John Roderick. Do you know that guy?
Is that from The Long Winters?
Yeah, the singer from The Long Winters.
Yeah. I'm friendly with him. I didn't know about his walking across the country, though.
So he did a big, long walk across Europe as he was coming out of his drug addiction. And he talks about it sometimes on the podcast that he does with Merlin Mann. And every time it's the minutiae of it rather than the here's what I learned. It's a man who just wanted to go walking. And I think that the heroism has been stripped from the narrative, which is what I like about it.
I like that too. That's cool. Yeah. I mean, I think in general, as far as storytelling goes, and we are all constantly being asked, especially with social media nowadays, to constantly tell our story. Ability to, you know, the ability to tell it matter-of-factly with humility, if there are heroic qualities of it, to allow others to ascribe those, I think that's a strong characteristic.
It's social media marketing, in essence. And I have spent a long time as somewhat of a social media marketer for a major music brand. And my thought on that is that what you are doing when you are using those platforms is, and I encourage everyone to do it, tell a story. And it's fascinating. Like, I understand that. Does that feel sometimes cumbersome to you as a creative artist?
No, it actually doesn't. I mean, somewhat the technology does, in a sense, because I never was first. I mean, I guess when I got my first four track, that was technology. I was interested. I learned how to do a bio and press package from reading Drum Media and On the Street. Those printing press is technology. So I guess. The way I envisioned my career was intimately connected to technology. I'm just sort of correcting myself. But I think what I like about it is that I'm someone who's always, you know, when you come from underground music or punk rock, you are constantly arguing for substance over style. You're constantly arguing for the message is in the intention and in the attitude. It's not even necessarily about the final product, meaning that you're obviously, as an adult, you've come to learn craftsmanship and all these types of things that you value. But if you have punk rock like in your blood, you basically are saying, watch me fight. That's where the entertainment is.
It's in being scrappy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think for me, one of the beautiful things about social media is that it allows you to focus on the larger fight rather than the individual product. it's not as much about being judged by every single you put out or every, it's way more about, look, we're circling back to some similar material in that it's really about the war of ideas. And it's about, as an artist, how strong are you on the battlefield in the war of ideas? And how influential are your ideas? And they're not necessarily quantifiable in terms of numbers. That's what I think is the, I mean, I've always believed that with music. Like, I cared more about who my fans were than how many of them there were.
Absolutely.
I've sort of come to realize, also living in America over so many years, that there is no way to become massively successful without basically convincing a lot of people that you don't particularly like to like you. Mm-hmm. That's the formula of it. You know, there's no way to do it otherwise. And I have some tolerance for that, but more than that, I want people I respect to like what I do. I think this whole, the way I use social media is, and I get a lot of people telling me that, as like people who observe me and my wife on social media, they like that we are clearly creative artists in a family. Like, we're not choosing an either or dynamic, because I think there's like a lot of people you can follow and understand their narratives, that are basically like wild edge thinkers that take you into that landscape. And then there are like family channels and mums that will give you their recipe for bread. And, you know, like,
right.
But the grounded reality of being working artists interested in creating subversive, clever, long-term impactful work over a lifetime is like, it does help to observe each other. You do need role models for that. And you do need touchstones so that you can go like, so someone who's young and, you know, trying to figure it out can go, hey, well, that guy can do it. I mean, I've had a lot of artists, you know, I mean, so many artists who've gone on to really successful careers, bigger than mine. I've had moments of sitting down with like early in their careers and them kind of going like, how do you do it? Like, how do you not back out of it? How do you not buckle under pressure? How do you, like, you do get courage. I think it's overly dramatic to call it mentorship, but having touchstones, just going, it can be done.
Yeah.
That person is clearly paying their bills and doing work they love. It can be done.
And that's what's important. And the thing that I think makes you relatable on social media as an observer of it is that you present yourself as a human being more so than as a brand. And I think that that is the sort of thing that will innately make your fans feel closer to you. And last year, accidentally, I started a global meme that went for a couple of days that wound up in the brand Netflix posting the word Netflix to their 16, 17 million followers.
Wait, hold on. You're going to have to give me more info. What's the meme though?
Okay, so the meme is,
okay,
you write your own name on Facebook. And that was it. That was the idea. But what happened was that I told people that it was an exercise in brand marketing because—
Wait, you wrote Max Quinn?
Yep. That's what
you
I did.
You just wrote it.
I just typed the phrase Max Quinn and people commented. And I was like, oh, I can trick people into thinking that this is a thing. And that's precisely what happened.
So wait, there was no intention behind it initially?
There was no intention in trying to solve the brand marketing algorithm. It was.
But was it a thought experiment or was it a lighthearted joke?
Lighthearted joke. Absolutely. Okay. For me, I think that the winking in doing it is part of the fun of social media, in being able to say to the audience, hey, here I am, Max Quinn, I'm engaging with you, and here we are engaging with each other, both with a smile on our faces, nodding, understanding. And so the point at which this became attractive to much larger brands is the point at which it proved fallibility, in that it looks like a mistake, right? It looks like an error. It looks like a fun accident that Netflix, in much the same way as your grandpa might type Netflix into the computer, that they are doing it as well is endearing. And
right.
out of all of this, you know, it was 3 or 4 days of stupidity in my life where I couldn't look at my phone. But the lesson that it taught me is that appearing fallible as a brand, appearing human as Ben Lee, is such an incredible, powerful tool of marketing because it brings people in closer to you and endears them to you as the creator, as the purveyor, as the brand.
Well, I think that's the only... I want to hear more about that, actually, but wait, let me ask you a question.
Mm.
How you said you couldn't look at your phone. How was there any implication of proprietariness to you when...
Like, oh, yeah. So basically what happened was that I posted it, did it, and then told people on Twitter and told people on Instagram, hey, this is a thing. And because of the work that I do in the music industry, lots of Australian bands were the early adopters of this. From there, when bands would do it, when other brands would jump on board, when people would do their own variations on it, someone would jump in the comments and the thing that they would type is Max Quinn.
Got it. Okay, I understand. Yeah, that's cool. I think for me, for many years... I'd say I'm trying to think up until when. Probably like I made an album called Rebirth of Venus, and that was probably the point where I realized that eclecticism and like, so I went on, this is going to be a bit of a roundabout way of talking about this, but I toured with artists a lot that had a lot more success than me through consistency. In like this band, you know, Dashboard Confessional.
Oh yeah, Chris.
Yeah. So like I toured with Chris and they were really big. Like we played, like I supported them. They played arenas. But he built an extremely dependable model of connection with his audience. And every night he came out and the audience was singing along. And it was like he clearly, like even his hair and his look was so amazing. And it was all incredibly consistent, like in the most organic sense of the term. It was branding in a relatable way. It was any of his audience could tell you what Dashboard Confessional meant. It was clear.
Yep.
You know, by that point we'd started probably around the same time, I think, maybe early 90s or something. I'd already been through like 5 different incarnations of what I wanted my sound to be like, what I was interested in, and I remember talking to Chris about it, and he was talking about feeling somewhat roped in to his he expressed, I guess what I'm saying is, we expressed a type of mutual envy for him for what he perceived as a certain type of freedom that I had. And for me, for his, like the stability of his model, his artistic model, and the income from that, and just the knowing what your year would be like, you know,
knowing and understanding. And
I'm very careful. I don't want to be like at all sort of superior about this, because I actually think what we were talking about yesterday, like almost my anger, it almost encouraged me to keep burning down my personas, you know? Like I would sort of look at my audience sometimes and I would go, I dislike you because you like me. let me throw you a curveball.
Yeah.
You know? So
keep you on your toes.
So it was sort of almost like, yeah, it was like reactive though, and kind of immature. Anyway, I think at a certain point I realized that I had to include my own eclecticism and my fickleness and my stubbornness and my my sort of thirst for new experiences into my brand.
As part of the...
That clearly you did have to have a brand in a sense that like, yeah, it just had to include it. It was like whatever version of capitalism I'm living in, I was not a good match for it unless it gave me the freedom to be as weird as I wanted to be.
Absolutely. And we talk about, in the first episode of this podcast, you talked a little bit about the period of time where you felt like you were too obtuse and wound up alienating your audience. Is this simpatico. Is that kind of what you're describing right now?
Yeah, and I guess like what happened is as I accepted that about myself, it started coming across as more playful rather than difficult. Like people started going like, oh yeah, he kind of does whatever he wants. It's fun.
He wears the yellow suit.
Yeah, as opposed to like, oh, what's he doing now? What's he, you know, like the energy behind it changed.
Yeah.
But so the thing with this whole branding thing is I think there's a authentic way and an inauthentic way of doing it. Like to me, even someone like Wayne Coyne from The Flaming Lips, like he sort of has a brand, you know, not sort of,
oh,
he
definitely.
Does. Like it's the colors and the stonery thing and the psychedelia and the bubbles and the, you know, but I also sense the human in there playing with, like, he's got the mask and he's showing you his truth through it.
Yes.
I think he's having a fun playfulness with his brand. And that to me is, I'm a little, again, he's someone who's managed to whittle it down to an expression that, I don't know, maybe I will be like that. I've always viewed myself as playing a very long game. So I might find the discovery of my iconic self, whatever that is, like like the self that's, you know, perhaps for most musical artists, maybe there's one song and one photograph that at the end of the day, if you could put him in a time capsule, that sort of goes like, and look, if you're Bob Dylan, you've got 15 of them. But for most people, there's like, if you get one, you're lucky. It may well be that that's something that I touch on. I've always had a very weird hunch that I actually am going to reach the full expression of my own artistry in my like 70s.
Cool.
I always felt that that was what I wanted to do because I saw it as inseparable to my own life. And if I wanted to continue to get more experience and hopefully get wiser and make mistakes and learn from them, naturally, the crowning achievement of whatever wisdom you manage to get should be near the end. You know, not that nowadays 70 is not that old. But so I do look at that. I look at artists who have like somehow managed to capture these iconic expressions. They've whittled it down to these moments. And I've sort of felt like I haven't really done that. So I have no choice other than to continue mining this, you know, this coal mine and see where it takes me.
Seeing where it happens, you know, and I think that for some artists, as you say, there are those defining moments, and then there are other artists who come back and they're wearing a hat, you know?
Yeah.
And I have no doubt that you're going to have enough moments to not be defined by a hat, Ben.
I got some good hats, though, I got to tell you.
Do you really? Oh, yeah, okay, tomorrow, hat chat and then oils.
Okay, sounds good, mate.
Okay.
Cheers.
Talk to you later, Ben.
See ya. Bye.
Ben Lee in Quarantine is a collaboration between me, Max Quinn, and Ben Lee. I'm doing all the mixing and producing and editing and stuff. Sorry if you run into any pops or clicks or bung audio. I'm trying. Thank you to Ben. You can find him on the internet at Ben Lee Music. You can say hi to me at Max Quinn. We'll have another episode for you real soon.